Madam Secretary, the next item. Oh, capital budget. We are in third reading on the on Senate Bill 100. Mr. Minority Leader.
Thank you, Mr. President. This is the state capital budget, major piece of legislation. I refer to it as legislation of mass construction. Millions of dollars here of state money for projects across the state, some of which I support and some of which I still have some questions about. And needless to say, this is still a work in progress. There are other of our colleagues among us who will pass judgment on this and possibly make changes. So at this time, this legislation doesn't have my full confidence, but again, it is a work in progress. I hope that it improves along the way. I know hard work has gone into this version of the bill, but there are changes yet to come, and I reserve judgment until that day. I would appeal to you, as I have privately, Mr. President, and the members of your caucus, and will do so again here publicly, just appeal for fairness, regional balance, making sure that we're putting a priority on those projects that will create wealth and assist Alaskans and provide the infrastructure we need to move the state forward together. So we'd ask you to think about those concerns, and let's work together to do a good capital budget, or one that we can call good in the final analysis. Thank you.
Thank you. Just to make sure everybody understands, the bill is before us in third reading. It is available in third reading. Don't go back to second reading if any member would like to propose that a project be removed. So that is available to any member. Do we have further debate? Senator Taylor.
I just wondered if that also applied to a project being added.
That's always possible. Is there any further debate? I think we have a member coming back in. Nope. Brief at ease. The Senate come back to order. We are in third reading under debate. Senator Wilken.
President, I won't go through the capital budget today, but I would just like to say a couple of things. One is that the very things the minority leader spoke of are the very things that drove the construction of this capital budget and will continue to drive it for the next 6 days. I would like to say to you, Mr. President, thank you for the honor of putting this this budget together, and I would like to say thank you to a certain number of people, that being my staff, Darwin Peterson, Pete Eklund from the other body, who is the assistant to the co-chair. The four of us, have worked closely together. But mostly, Mr. President, I would like to say thank you to the agencies. This has been indeed a refreshing experience. This budget allows you to touch every agency, hundreds of people all coming together for the very thoughts that the minority leader spoke of. Build Alaska, to build it, and build it to provide infrastructure and do it fairly. So those agencies, I want to say thanks for your cooperation, for your honesty, and for you joining the team that is trying to build Alaska. And Mr. President, that's what this capital budget does. I commend it to your consideration. Thank you.
Do we have any further debate? Seeing none, the question before the body is, shall committee substitute for Senate Bill 100 finance pass the Senate? Members may proceed to vote. Secretary will lock the roll. Does any member wish to change his or her vote? Secretary will tally the roll.
12 yeas, 8 nays.
So by a vote of 12 yeas to 8 nays, committee substitute for Senate Bill 100 finance has passed the Senate. Mr. Majority Leader.
I move the effective date clauses.
The effective date clauses have been moved. Are there any questions? Seeing none, members may proceed to vote. Secretary will lock the roll. Does any member wish to change his or her vote? Secretary will tally the roll.
12 yeas, 8 nays.
So by voting 12 yeas, 8 nays, the effective date clauses have failed to pass the Senate. Mr. Majority Leader. Senator Lincoln.
Mr. President, I just wanted to give notice of reconsideration on SB 30. I thought we were through with this vote. Sorry about that.
Well, we don't have a pending motion. You can give notice of reconsideration.
I do.
On Senate Bill 30. Mr. Majority Leader.
Thank you, Mr. President. I move the vote on Section 14D, Constitutional Budget Reserve Draw.
Section 14D has been moved. That is the specific 17C section. Requires a three-quarter vote. Are there any questions? Is there any debate? Seeing none, members may proceed to vote. Secretary will lock the roll. Does any member wish to change his or her vote? Secretary, tally the roll.
12 yeas, 8 nays.
So by a vote of 12 yeas to 8 nays, the Section 14D fails to pass the Senate. Mr. Majority Leader.
Mr. President, I move the vote for Section 14A, Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund.
Section 14A has been moved as a separate motion. That is a CBR draw for the sweep provisions, the reverse sweep provisions. Do we have any questions or any debate? Seeing none, members may proceed to vote. Secretary will lock the roll. Does any member wish to change his or her vote? Secretary will tally the roll.
12 yeas, 8 nays.
So by a vote of 12 yeas, 8 nays, Section 14A fails to pass the Senate. Mr. Majority Leader.
Mr. President, I move Section 14B, Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund.
14B section is the CBR draw for the fiscal year 2004 budget. Are there questions? Seeing none, members may proceed to vote. Secretary will lock the roll. Does any member wish to change his or her vote? Secretary will tally the roll.
12 yeas, 8 nays.
So by a vote of 12 yeas, 8 nays, the 14B section fails to be approved under 17C. Mr. Majority Leader.
Thank you, Mr. President. I move Section 14C, Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund.
The 14C section is the payment of the management fees for the investments that are made out of the Constitutional Budget Reserve. Mr. Minority Leader.
Brief
at ease. I'm back to order. The 14C provision has been moved. Are there any questions? Seeing none, members may proceed to vote. Secretary will lock the roll. Does any member wish to change his or her vote? Secretary will tally the roll.
11 yeas, 8 nays.
By a vote of 11 yeas, 8 nays, 14C provision has failed to pass under 17C of the Constitution.
CS for Senate Bill Number 102, Labor and Commerce. An act increasing the amount of revenue received by the state from charitable gaming activities, relating taxes on poll tabs, and providing for an effective date.
We are in third reading. Mr. Minority Leader.
Mr. President, I place a call on this item.
Call has been placed. Debate can continue while we are in satisfying the call. Do we have further debate? Senator Bundy.
Mr. President, I'd like to move and ask unanimous consent that we go back to second reading for a specific amendment, that being amendment number one that's on member's desk.
Without objection, we will go back to second reading. There is objection.
Point of order. Oh. Is it proper for a motion to be placed while the call is not yet satisfied?
You're right, Mr. Minority Leader. We will have to wait before we can take action on that motion. So brief at ease. Senate, come back to order. Senator Bundy, would you renew your motion, please?
Mr. President, I move and ask unanimous consent that we return to second reading for a specific amendment, that being amendment number one on member's desk.
Without objection, we will return to second reading. Senator Bundy.
I move amendment number one.
Amendment number one has been moved. Is there objection? There is objection. Senator
Speaking
Bundy.
To the amendment, this is an issue that was discussed in Labor and Commerce at length. It's an interesting conversation as we talk with people involved in charitable gaming, and many in charitable gaming feel that they can be pushed too far as far as the tax burden that they can bear, and some will go out of business and charities will suffer. This amendment simply says that the local governments, municipalities, could not have a tax on poll tabs or charitable gaming, that this would be reserved for a state taxing opportunity. And what happens, there's some three or four communities in the state that do tax poll tabs, and they basically get double taxed then. So So we're faced with the issue of either having it a statewide tax that full tabs sold in the majority of Alaska would provide revenue for the state, or we can have just a few communities realize revenue from this. And I, after a lot of conversation and testimony, I think that this is the best for all of the state of Alaska to exempt pull tabs from local taxation.
Further debate, Senator Elton.
Thank you, Mr. President. I mean, I don't mind having this discussion, but this discussion ought to occur in local assemblies. My community is one of those communities that does level a sales tax on pull tabs. It was the result of an extensive discussion at the community level, a decision that was made at the assembly level. The assembly essentially said, look, if we're going to tax Pampers, we're going to tax pull tabs. I'm not going to speak as to whether that's a good idea or a bad idea, but I will say that I think it's an idea and a decision that ought to be reserved to the local communities, who have every right under Title 29 to levy a sales tax. And it's not like we're saying we're going to reserve something to the state. I mean, cities have the right to levy a sales tax. They have the right to determine what's an exempt sale and what's not an exempt sale. Just like to point out, I don't know how other communities do it, but I'd like to point out that the receipts from the CBJ sales tax on pull tabs go into a fund for youth organizations and nonprofits. Again, a decision that ought to be left to local government and ought not be dictated by the state after discussions in one committee or another or on the floor. So I would urge a no vote.
Do we have further debate? Seeing none, the question, Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. President. I also rise in opposition to this amendment. You know, local governments are having hard enough time providing the services that are required, and we continually cut the municipal assistance and revenue sharing, but we don't give them any other alternatives to raising revenues. And I think this would just take another option away from them. You know, I think that we should sit back and look at how we would feel if the federal government came and told us, hey, you know, your rates for raising revenue from oil taxes are too high. We're going to start restricting a portion of those. We wouldn't like that at all. You know, and I think that that's the perspective that we should take. This is something that they're exercising now and without us considering it in committee and having testimony. I think for us to do this at this time is not the right thing to do. Thank you.
Do we have further debate? Seeing none, the question before the body is, shall Amendment Number 1 pass the Senate? Members may proceed to vote. Secretary will lock the roll. Does any member wish to change his or her vote? Secretary will tally the roll.
13 yeas, 7 nays.
By a vote of 13 yeas, 7 nays, Amendment Number 1 has passed the Senate. That brings us back into third reading. Do we have further debate in third reading? Seeing none, question before the body is, shall committee substitute for Senate Bill 102, Labor and Commerce amended, pass the Senate? Members may proceed to vote. Secretary will lock the roll. Does any member wish to change his or her vote? Secretary will tally the roll.
12 yeas, 8 nays.
So by a vote of 12 yeas to 8 nays, committee substitute for Senate Bill 102, Labor and Commerce amended, has passed the Senate. Mr. Majority Leader.
Move the effective date clauses.
The effective date clauses have been moved. Any questions or debate? Seeing none, members may proceed to vote. Secretary will lock the roll. Does any member wish to change his or her vote? Secretary will tally the roll.
12 yeas, 8 nays.
So by a vote of 12 yeas to 8 nays, the effective date clauses have failed to pass the Senate. Senator Elton.
Give notice of reconsideration of my vote on committee substitute for Senate Bill 102.
Notice of reconsideration on Senate Bill 102 has been given. Next item.
CS for Senate Bill Number 117, Finance, an act relating to the longevity bonus program and providing for an effective date.
We are in third reading. Do we have debate? Mr. Minority Leader.
Thank you, Mr. President. I just wanted to let members of the body know that I was here in 1994. I came to the Senate and from the House of Representatives in 1992 and served here in 1994 with former Senator Jay Curtula. And there was an enormous amount of effort at that time, Mr. President, that went into consideration of an annuity plan. After the court decision, people knew that there needed to be some sort of forward-looking plan put in place relating to the longevity bonus. And a great deal of thought and effort, legal opinions, analysis went into consideration of an annuity plan. And in the final analysis, there was not adequate number of votes on this floor to pass an annuity to maintain the longevity bonus in the same way it was before the court decision. So we made a very, very difficult decision at the time in consultation with many folks around the state. People were very passionate about this, as we know. And we made a very difficult decision to, because an annuity wasn't available to us and we didn't know what the future might hold, the difficult decision was made and the votes were mustered after all the speeches were made and all the points given that we should stair-step down or phase out over time the longevity bonus program. And I voted in favor of that. I made that difficult decision. I considered a promise and a commitment because a lot of the senior citizens were people that have grown older over the years, obviously, and live on fixed incomes, many of them. And other folks use this money to plan out their budgets and plan for the necessities of life. And I felt like I made a promise in 1994, and I intend to keep it today by voting no on this legislation, regardless of the position of the man upstairs. And I don't mean, Mr. President, the supreme being, but regardless of anybody's position, regardless of which floor they may be from in this building, I will not break that commitment. I will not break that promise. There are too many senior citizens in my district and across the state who live on a fixed income and depend on the longevity bonus. And to break that promise with this bill, I think would be a major mistake and a betrayal of many people who sent me here to Juneau to represent their interests. And I do believe it's not just their individual interests or their group interest as senior citizens and longevity bonus recipients. I really do believe it's the state interest because these senior citizens and elders all across the state are a great reservoir, Mr. President, of wisdom, experience in our state, many, many years of experience, and they are the folks who have stuck around. They have not moved to Sequim or to Phoenix, but they have stayed here and they spend their money in the local economy, their pensions, their other benefit checks beyond the longevity bonus. They spend it here and they volunteer in the community, whether it be with the Retired Senior Volunteer Program or foster grandparents, big brothers, big sisters. You all have heard the stories and know the involvement of the seniors and elders who benefit from the bonus program, who are active members of your community. Many of them you see when you go to the polls. They're poll workers. They're people who are involved in our community and contribute to our state. They have for many years. And, Mr. President, I just think it would be a real mistake to adopt this legislation. And again, I made a promise, and I intend to keep it today.
Thank you. Do we have further debate? Senator Elton?
Well, I too think this is a mistake. And I hate to talk about an issue that has both an emotional and economic impact. I hate to just focus on the economics, but I'm going to try to for a few minutes. The last good look that we had at this program, it cost us about $47 million. The cost goes down every year. Every one of those $47 million ricochets in our economy. It goes through car dealerships. It goes through laundromats. It goes to the hardware store, the grocery store. People spend that money in the state because they only get that money if they're in the state, the way this program is structured. I, too, remember, as the minority leader does, those days not too long ago when Alaskans retired, they had to make decisions about where they're going to live, how they're going to live, who they're going to live close to. And because of programs like the longevity bonus, they made a decision to stay here. and not just spend the $46 or $47 million that they're getting on the longevity bonus, but to spend their health insurance benefits in our local economy, spend their pensions in our local economy, to spend the investments that they made over a long period of time in our local economy. We're going to get to the point, my mother used to say, and my mother is of an age where if she were living here, she'd qualify for the longevity bonus, and so maybe the seniors in our state will understand the phrase that she always used when I was growing up. You tug on the shorts at one end of the clothesline, the whole clothesline jumps. And this clothesline, when it begins jumping, essentially means that $47 million plus pension benefits, plus health insurance, plus investments may not be spent in Alaska anymore. Be spent in Sun City or Fayetteville or some other place where they may be forced to make an economic decision to move to so that they can maintain the lifestyle they thought they could maintain here when a commitment was made that they'd get a longevity bonus. For some senior couples, this is a $500 a month hit. And I wouldn't blame many of them at all if they decided, I can't afford it here anymore without that $500. And when they make that decision, they're taking their money with them. There are states that want our seniors. There are states that market to our seniors, saying, come on down. Bring your pensions with you. I think it was 2 or 3 years ago, a study was done by an economics research firm in the state of Alaska. At that time, they described the total economy in the state of Alaska as about a $17 billion economy. $2.4 billion of that $17 billion, $2.4 billion, more than $1 out of every $8, was attributed to the senior economy. We're jerking on the shorts. I think the whole clothesline jumps, and we don't know what falls out or who moves where because of it. And I would encourage a no vote because of the damage we may be doing to our already fragile economy. And if that's not a good enough reason, vote no, because we made a commitment 10 years ago that people counted on when they made their retirement decisions. And we're changing it now, and that's simply not fair.
Do we have further debate? Senator Lincoln.
Thank you, Mr. President. Mr. President, I was here when we made that commitment 10 years ago. And I remember the debate that we had here in both bodies, on whether we were going to have a longevity bonus and what that meant, and whether somebody who was a millionaire or a billionaire in Alaska would receive the same amount as somebody who was on a fixed income or who was on welfare. And that debate went on for a long time. But we did make a commitment to our senior citizens that we wanted to give them something back, a special something for their commitment to our state. And as was pointed out, $2 billion, that money, their money, that was generated through our economy, keeping us going. And those same people that we're contributing to and helping, of saying a thank you, I think now for us to say, well, you know, we're in a slump here and everybody's got to feel the pain. And so those of you who are 72 years of age and older that are on the longevity bonus, you have to feel the pain as well. And we're going to renege on our deal that we made with you just a short decade ago. Mr. President, in the McDowell Group study that was done, the Matsu Borough, 65% of the longevity bonus recipients said they could not get along without the bonus payments. And we know, or I know anyway, that that percentage is higher for rural Alaska. I was asked by the media, well, now, Senator Lincoln, you know, if you would reduce those that are not dependent upon the bonus, and what if it's just a needs basis? And I said emphatically, without hesitation, that that's not on my agenda. that I believe that when we did make that commitment, we made it to all of those folks that were 65 years of age and older. And we now have those that are receiving $50 a month, not $250, or as a couple, $500. You know, I really do think about where, and I received a lot of emails, I received a lot of handwritten letters from elders, I received phone calls from elders, but just think about that 80-year-old that lives in a small community where groceries could be 4 or 5 times higher than in urban areas, electricity 5 times higher, even with PCE, and suddenly you find that your monthly income is reduced $50, $250, $500. I can't look our elders or seniors in the eye and say, well, you know, you gotta hurt too. We're in a slump here and you gotta feel part of this pain. Those are individuals who brought us to where we are today. Those are the individuals who were there to support us through the good times, through the bad times. Those were the individuals who had that historical background to say, here's where we need to go with the state. Here's how I would like to help. I want to stay in the state. And you hear all the time, thank you. I mean, $50. $50 a month. Thank you for that. Thank you for that check. Or $250. Thank you for that check. Mr. President, when the argument is, well, there's folks who are very wealthy and get the $250 a month. Those individuals have to sit down every month and fill out that form. That we're still here with you, that we still would like to have the $250 a month. I say, I'm proud to give them that check because it's saying a thank you to them. A thank you for the contribution that they have made to our state. We shouldn't deny that. And I don't know for, you know, the how much we're going to save the first year, the second year. These are folks that are 72 years of age. We lose our elders every single year. Those numbers are not increasing. They're decreasing. And so for us on this body now to say, you know, all bets are off. We really didn't mean just a short 10 years ago. We didn't really mean it. And this wasn't something that was going to go on until the end of your life. I can't do that. I can't push that yes button because that's not right for our elders anywhere they live in Alaska. That's not right for our elders regardless of what their income is. We made a deal with them 10 short years ago. I think we should live by it. And I intend to do that with a no vote on this bill.
Senator Bundy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Referring to the deal that's been referred to, I think we should go back, clear back to the enabling legislation that began this program. And to quote then the Speaker of the House, Pertula, and he said, do this, and if in 15 or 20 years the state can't afford it, they can simply cut it out. So I think that's when the deal was made.
Do we have further debate, Senator Elton?
In brief response, I remember that quote from then Representative Curtula. And I think it's important to remind people that as recently as several weeks ago, he reminded people that he doesn't think it is time to repeal the dividend.
Thank you. Mr. Majority Leader.
Thank you, Mr. President. You know, I may be actually only one of the ones that was actually here when the first debate on this program came in place, but I wasn't a member of the body, I was a child. And I received a letter from my friend, former president of this body, Clem Tillion. who was the original sponsor of the legislation. In the original legislation, Mr. President, you had to be 65 years of age at the time of the enactment of the legislation, and you had to have been a resident of the state at statehood. That was the original intent of this legislation. And then we all know that it changed after a lawsuit from a gentleman named Mr. Zobel, who changed a lot of things the way we were trying to distribute the wealth that we received from the development of the North Slope. Mr. Zobel changed those rules and said anybody who's 65 years old can receive this money, as long as they've been in Alaska for a year. And that's when the change came that was spoken of earlier. And it changed yet again, and it said, okay, well, anybody who's 65 from this point forward can get it, but anybody that turns 65 next year doesn't get it. So now we have a class of citizens that living in rural Alaska, living in southern Alaska, living in central Alaska, and some of those that are 65 years of age get it, and some of them don't. Some of those people that were born and raised here live there their whole life, who turned 65 after that date, don't get it. Some of those that came here after the age of 65 but qualified at that period, they do get it. And so now here we are faced again with another decision on, can we afford this program, and is it equitable and a fair distribution of the limited resources we have left? Well, my friend Mr. Tillion sent us that letter, and he said to us, as well as to the governor, he said, I was the original sponsor of that bill, and the bill has changed, and the program has changed. He receives that money, Mr. President. He and his wife have received it since the beginning, since the time they turned 65. And he says, you'll take the money from me. I served in the legislature. He served here. He was here before statehood. And he says, well, I missed the money. He says, yes. He says, well, I shed a tear for it. I probably will. And he says, if I was in your position, I would vote to eliminate the program. The man who sponsored the legislation said that. So for someone in my position, Mr. President, someone I'll never receive it, never consider to receive it. I have lots of people that know to receive it. But to me, Mr. President, that's a vote of confidence. It's a signal to me that it's time for us to wind this program down for good, knowing that the times that created the original thought of the $900 million that came in 1968 in that lease sale, when they all said, how are we going to share this? Well, we all know that's gone. And so with that, Mr. President, I encourage a yes vote. Thank you.
We have further debate. Senator Guess.
Thank you, Mr. President. Well, if the majority leader was here and Clem Chillion was here, most likely I was here, but I don't remember. And unfortunately, I first rise to declare conflict of interest because my mother-in-law receives a longevity bonus. So I wanted to do that. I actually wanted to stand and say how disappointed I am in ARP. All I know is they're saying that they represent seniors and this is what seniors want. I am one of the few people on this floor, my friend from State Affairs, I know is the other, that sat through the 4.5 hours, every minute of it, just to side note that I was in committee, of the testimony. I can tell you from listening to that testimony, this isn't what longevity bonus recipients want, and it shouldn't be characterized as that. If the majority or if the members of this body want to make this vote and want to pass this elimination of a longevity bonus, we are the policymaking body, or the people who vote for it are. But let's not characterize this as this is what longevity bonus recipients want. It's not. And I'm not sure why ARP is going around saying that. It's very disappointing to me that a group that says they advocate and they protect seniors, one, would make this compromise, and two, try to characterize it as something that the recipients would want or that they think is fair. It is difficult. Although the majority and leader and I might have been here, we weren't in control back then. And if we were meant to make this policy today, we'd be making a very different policy. But it is about a promise. It is about a commitment. It is about, and I know you disagree, Mr. President, it is about, I think, how we treat our elders, if anything else. It is about a population who, many who testified, didn't get Social Security, weren't around when there were pensions, cannot go back to work. And yet we say, sorry, and we're in a bunch of crunch, and you're going to be one of the first ones. I'm not saying that the policy necessarily makes logical sense, and if we were here today, we would do something similar, but I think we have to look at it holistically. With that, Mr. President, I thank you.
Do we have further debate? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. President. You know, as you look at the situation that is going to hopefully all afflict us, assuming we don't have a tragic event before we do get old, and as the light of life starts to fade on the horizon of humanity, and these people that are on a fixed income are out there looking at us and what we're going to be doing with a portion of what they get every month. In this particular case, it's especially sensitive to me because both of my parents were raised by their grandparents because of TB and other difficulties that are there. Now, out in rural Alaska, we still have grandparents that are raising grandchildren and are fully dependent on this. In my particular case, there in Golovin, we have a store, Olson and Sons, started by my dad, and many times, and having been raised in the store, we have extended credit to elders within the community because they have promised to pay their bill when their longevity bonus comes in the mail, because their word is as good as gold, and because they have no other means of income. I urge a no vote on this particular bill, Mr. President. Thank you.
Do we have further debate? Seeing none, the question, Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. President. I, too, rise up in opposition to this bill, you know, and I guess I'm just a little bit disappointed in the leadership of AARP. I've had several emails from seniors saying that they haven't been contacted by AARP and don't represent them on this question. I would like to associate my comments with the senator from Golovin and others that stand up today opposing the legislation. during the hearings in Senate Finance, I did not hear one person come up and testify in favor of the previous legislation. And although there was some discussion about changes to the legislation, I did not, I don't recall, there may have been, but I don't recall anyone coming up and bartering away or bargaining away the program over several years. You know, many of the seniors their numbers will diminish over the years, and maybe the results of this program won't affect as many people as are presently receiving it. But in closing, Mr. President, this is a bad bill. This is a bad, bad bill.
Thank you. Do we have further debate? Seeing none, the question before the body is, shall committee substitute for Senate Bill 117, Finance, pass the Senate? Members may proceed to vote. Secretary will lock the roll. Does any member wish to change his or her vote? Secretary will tally the roll.
11 yeas, 9 nays.
By a vote of 11 yeas, 9 nays, committee substitute for Senate Bill 117, Finance, has passed the Senate. Mr. Majority Leader.
Thank you, Mr. President. Move the effective date clauses.
The effective date clauses are moved. Members have any questions or debate? Seeing none, members may proceed to vote. Secretary will lock the roll. Does any member wish to change his or her vote? Secretary will tally the roll.
11 yeas, 9 nays.
So by a vote of 11 yeas, 9 nays, the effective date clauses fail to pass the Senate. Senator Guess.
Thank you, Mr. President. I'd like to serve notice of reconsideration on my vote of CS for SB 117.
Notice of reconsideration on Senate Bill 117 has been given. Mr. Minority Leader.
Brief at ease, please.
Brief at ease. The Senate come back to order. Mr. Majority Leader.
Place call on the Senate, Mr. President.
Call has been placed on the Senate. We can continue debate while the call is being satisfied.
CS for Senate Bill Number 119, Finance, an act authorizing the Alaska Public Offices Commission to issue advisory opinions amending campaign financial disclosure and reporting requirements, campaign contribution limits, provisions related to contributions after elections, and provisions related to unused campaign contributions, providing for expedited consideration of and modifying procedures for determining violations of state election campaign laws, amending the time period within which to file an administrative complaint of a violation of state election campaign laws, amending the definitions of express communication and political party for state election campaigns, amending the registration fee for lobbyists, providing for increased use of electronic filing for reports to the Alaska Public Offices Commission, adding a definition of commission in the regulation of lobbying laws, amending the requirements for reporting of financial interests by public officials, adding a definition of domestic partner in the Legislative Ethics Code and in the public official financial disclosure requirements, allowing classified employees to take an active part in political party management, making conforming amendments, and providing for an effective date.
We are in third reading. Do we have debate? Senator French.
Just a question for whoever it is carrying the bill here today. It's a 23-page bill, and it went through a lot of amendments and known a lot of committees. My question has to do with the role of a lobbyist and that lobbyist's ability to donate money outside his or her own district. As I read the bill, the answer is now no under Section 13 of the bill on page 8. If someone knows differently, I'd like to know.
Senator, Mr. Majority Leader.
Thank you, Mr. President. The senator that I share my northern boundary with is correct that this bill leaves in place the restriction on lobbyists so that they can only contribute to the member that represents their residence only. And for the pleasure of the members, this is the Senate Finance Committee version. And it made a few changes, not real substantial changes, but let me just highlight some of them. First of all, let me remind everybody that this version came from the recommendations from the Alaska Public Offices Commission themselves. They brought this down and said, these are our recommended changes, and we all know that bill has gone through, to put it politely, a meat grinder process. And this is the product. Like it or not, these bills affect us. This bill affects us as candidates, as public officials. It affects also, Mr. President, the member of the Board of Tattoo Specialists that we passed last year. It affects the people that serve on the Board of Nursing. It affects people that serve as commissioners and as volunteers for state boards and commissions. So we're not the only ones that this affects. But in terms of the campaign section that it does affect, some of the things that have happened that I want to highlight is, as the senator from Anchorage noted, it keeps the restriction on lobbyists, allowing them to only contribute to the members that represent the districts they reside in. It increases the lobbying fee, filing fee, from $100 per client to $250 per client. One of the other things it does, Mr. President, it prohibits candidates, it continues the prohibition on candidates and members of the legislature from holding fundraising events in Juneau during the session, which we all know is a good prohibition. Act, Mr. President, it deletes the provision that would have removed municipalities from APOC's jurisdiction. This was quite a concern for a lot of municipal candidates and municipal officers that they wouldn't have a system for reporting on their officials and candidates. So this takes it back to the law that it was under the current law. It changes group contributions to a candidate or a group that was reduced from $5,000 to $2,000, and it takes it back and says a group can contribute $2,000 to a candidate and $4,000 to a party, which is a change. One of the other things that it does, Mr. President, Section 18, it incorporates what's called the FERGAT standard, which is express communication during a campaign, which says if an independent group spends, hires a campaign and actually speaks of an express communication that either endorses a candidate or votes or has a negative connotation toward a candidate, that must be reported, and that's part of the new McCain-Feingold case of reasonable interpretation. That's a new one. Some of the specifics that it changes in terms of the contribution limits. The contribution limits have been changed across many of the items. As I said, contribution limits for the individuals to contribute to candidates is from $500 to $1,000 limit. From individuals to contribute to a party is from $5,000 to $10,000. From groups to contribute to candidates, excuse me, from PACs to candidates, I said that was 1,000 to 2,000. Groups to parties is 1,000 to 4,000. And from non-group entities or advocacy nonprofit corporations, the limits have gone from 500 to 1,000. This is a complex bill, Mr. President. I hope I'm not boring everybody, but it has a lot of impact on what we do when we're not here and what people do to get here. It also, Mr. President, eliminates the 10-day report and allows candidates to close out their campaign reports on February 15th instead of filing the 10-day report immediately after the campaign. It allows for expedient electronic reporting. It allows for APOC to require electronic reporting administration, and the legislature is funding a capital project to establish the system for electronic reporting. I supported that, and I'd still support that. Well, and then one of the things that it's done, Mr. President, for legislators and public officials in a section that has to do with our personal financial disclosures, it was recommended by APOC to raise those limits that have to do with our own personal income, our own personal stock ownership, or our own personal business relationships, the relationships of our spouse or our domestic equivalent, and the relationships of our children. Our dependent children. It raised those limits from reporting requirements from $1,000 to $10,000 for each one of those individually. Again, Mr. President, I want to again emphasize the fact that we're not the only individuals affected by this, by these reporting requirements, specifically under the personal disclosure of public officials. We heard in testimony, we heard in committee, that many times the reporting requirements of officials that voluntarily serve don't necessarily want to make public their financial conditions or their financial relationships with other companies or other people. I can speak personally, Mr. President, from prior to becoming a legislator, I did serve voluntarily on a commission that I was appointed to, and it was an onerous thing. I was fined because I didn't get the report in on time because I was at sea fishing at the time when it was required, and I couldn't fill out the report saying that my report was going to be late. So I got fined twice over that. Maybe I have a conflict with even speaking about this. Anyway, Mr. President, again, it is a complex bill, but in reality, the changes are, I think I've highlighted the major changes as well as the minor changes. One of the things that there's one other piece that I need to tell everybody, and that has to do with our reporting requirements on contribution levels. from our contributors. Our contributors can contribute up to 0 to 100 without having for us to report their name. From 100 to 250, we are to report the name and address of the contributor. And if they exceed $250 to $1,000, we are to report the name, address, and employer of that contributor. There is one other piece in here I think that we'll all find that it's happy. And it says, in the placed in statute, the spaghetti feed exemption for 25 people and under $50. So those of us that have large spaghetti feed type events that turn into fundraisers, we're not required to report their names, each of them individually. So with that, Mr. President, if there's any further discussions, I think this is a bill that has evolved and has been turned over upside down, but you know, they've been threatened, they've been coerced, they've been lobbied, and this is a bill that I think we can, that affects all of us, and it's a good disclosure law. In some instances, it didn't go as far as what I thought we should go to, but I recommend a yes vote. Thank you.
Do we have further debate? Senator French.
Thank you, Mr. President. I appreciate the good explanation from the senator with whom I share a southern border. That's kind of how you should look at it, I think. And I appreciate the fact that lobbyists can't give statewide donations under this bill. Had that provision remained in the bill, I think I would have had to call this bill an apocalypse. That's apocalypse. tough crowd. But the part I really don't like is the part that doubles the amount of contributions. That's the part I want to spend at least a couple of minutes talking about, because really that comes down to the real mother's milk of politics, which is money. We've doubled the amounts that a person can give. We've doubled the amounts a person can give to a candidate. We've doubled the amounts a person can give to a party. We've doubled the amounts that a union or a PAC, actually the union's PAC or a PAC, can give to a candidate. And basically what that does is it raises the price of an election. It raises the price of a seat in this body or in the other body. And the higher you raise the price of a seat, the tougher it is for a contender, the tougher it is for a citizen to get his way into an elected seat. It's a brute fact of political reality that 90% of the elections in this country are won by the candidate that raises more money. 90% of the elections in this country are won by the candidate that raises more money. And so the real trick to getting elected is to raise a lot of cash. Who pressed for this change in the law? I'm not sure, and I guess I'm a bit disappointed if AIPAC was pressing for it, or whether they were talked into it, or whether they were persuaded to think it was a good idea. I don't know. But I can promise you it wasn't the little guy home working at his job, or the little guy home working at his business, or the little guy at home trying to put food on the table. Those folks who never donate don't want to see the price of an election go up. Those folks who never send a check off to a political candidate don't want to see the price go up. And I can assure you that from their perspective, this looks like a way to keep the rich folks in office and keep the poor folks from getting down here and having a say. One of the ways to think about this is to ask yourself, why are there any limits on contributions? Why do we have any contribution limits whatsoever? If you have some kind of a right to donate to political candidates, if you have a right to donate to political parties, then why have any limit whatsoever? Why not say the sky's the limit and just let it be a pure dollar fight? Why not let Bill Gates and Warren Buffett duke it out to see who can get the most legislators in their camps? Well, we would all kind of recoil from that idea. You recoil from it in distaste because it just seems a little too much. And the reason it seems like it's a little too much is because you sense right away that there's something profoundly wrong with letting the richest person elect the greatest number of legislators. So what I enjoy doing, I guess, is asking myself the next question, and that is, what if you pushed it all the way down? What if you pushed it all the way down to nothing so that the only thing you had to influence an election was your vote, your one vote? Wouldn't that be the best system? Now, that's unrealistic, and yet I'm intrigued by that idea because it strikes me that that's really the basis for what we're doing here, and it's the basis of representational democracy. That is one person, one vote, and not $1,000 per individual. So I guess I'll just close by saying it struck me that we had a pretty good system in place. The $500 limit, the $5,000 to a party, the $1,000 from a PAC struck me as being a pretty good balance. I felt absolutely no pressure from my constituents to double that amount. And so in closing, I'll say that I'm going to be voting no, and I hope the rest of you all will vote no, to let newcomers have a chance to come down here and keep fresh blood in this legislature and to keep the perception alive that this is a house of the people and not the money house.
Further debate. Senator Taylor.
Yeah, a couple of those I just couldn't resist. It's like fishing for trout. You throw a big enough gob of eggs out there, something's going to come up. And I did on this one. I've had the honor and the privilege, and I don't use those terms lightly in this regard, of having served with some of the most wonderful, talented people in the world. In my brief career, I have served in public office with well over 200 people elected by the people of Alaska. I've served at the borough level. I've served on the bench and worked with the judges of the state of Alaska. And I've had the privilege of serving both in the other body and in this one for a lengthy time. Some may say too long. But I'm honored to have known those people because of the quality of people that they were. And I have always been offended by the perception that generates this concept and the whole concept of APOC and the reporting requirements and the investigations that come out of it, the claims that are filed by one adverse candidate against another often, or one of their supporters is where it comes from. There's an old adage down here. We operate on perception far more than we do on reality. And tragically, what has happened is that we have allowed a perception, a mythology, actually, that's out there in the public. I mean, how many times have you heard the shot, all you guys in Juneau are on the take? How many times have you heard the criticism of the politician, you know? Check your hands after you shake hands. Check your fingers after you shake hands with him. Count your fingers. Make sure you still got them all, right? Well, I tell you, from my life experience, I haven't seen that yet. I have seen people elected, though, to office, even in this legislature, so naive and so believing in that public perception. One gentleman I served with, in a quiet conversation to one side, said to me, "Rob, has anybody tried to buy your vote?" I said, "What are you talking about?" Well, he says, "You know, you hear the rumors and stuff." He said, "There must be some controversial vote where that comes up." And he said, "Because I can't afford to live on this $1,115 net take-home pay that I get as a legislator. Surely there must be somebody coming around." I was incredulous. I said, "You're crazy." I said, if that's ever happened, and I can't say that it didn't, but I said, I've certainly never experienced, never seen it, never heard a rumor of it, didn't know about it if it did occur. I said, the people of Alaska don't elect a bunch of jerks. They elect pretty darn nice folks that are honest and moral, and they know them pretty well from their hometowns, or they wouldn't send them down here. At the end of a two-year term, he went back home because he was really disappointed that nobody had come around and tried to buy his vote. That's a tragic story in many ways, but I think it's humorous. It's humorous to me because, tragically, it is believed out there. And can you do anything to destroy that perception? I don't know. Can we pander to the public enough tonight? Can we prove to the public that, by golly, we're going to report every single dime? We're going to make certain that nobody gives me a nickel that I'm not going to report to you. Some kid comes up to me and gives me 25 cents. I'm going to write down, let's see, his name, his address, his occupation, and then I have to file that within a given period of time. That's what some advocates of this legislation would like to have. And they say they're doing this to protect the public of Alaska from the evil influences of big money. I love the one about the lobbyist. That's just a classic. A lobbyist cannot contribute to a candidate unless they live in that candidate's district. God, I wish we could just restrict them to only lobbying that candidate. Wouldn't that be nice? They could come to Juneau, they could say, "Can't talk to you, Rob. I don't live in your district. I can only talk to my friend over here who I was able to contribute money to because I live in his district." What a joke. Does anybody out there really, in the real world, think that since they can only give money to the candidate that lives in their district, that they can only lobby that candidate? That they can only try to influence that candidate's vote? Do we really think that the people who elected each of us in this room are that naive? I don't think they're that naive. I don't think they're that foolish. But we're doing foolish gestures to make them feel good. And then the comment has been made, how would a new candidate ever get a shot at running for office because those incumbents have got so much money and power, you know? Somebody needs to tell that to Slade Gordon, who had Marie Cantwell come out of the woodwork and spend over $37 million running against him. And your statistic, my friend from Anchorage, is absolutely correct. The statistics say that 90-some percent of those people who, quote, raise the most money will probably get elected. Only problem is, it isn't who raises the most money, it's who spends the most money. Does anybody really believe John Lindauer went out and did hot dog sales? I don't. I happen to have been a participant in that farce. Did AIPAC protect you or me against John Lindauer? No, they couldn't quite get around to that. Did they protect us against any of the other things that went on in the last several years? No, it takes them about a year and a half after the election before they can figure out who to fine, who to sanction, and usually it's like with John, $15,000. That really had to hurt him when he spent a million plus. What about those guys that come out of the woodwork and just spend their own money? One of the very first political campaigns that I had the privilege of working on in the state of Alaska involved my good friend who sits in front of me, his father. And that's when, I met him as a younger man. I think I was younger then, too. He was running against Elmer Rasmussen. And it was the first big-money race in the new state of Alaska. Elmer outspent Ted Stevens 3-1. Elmer won the race. Now, did Elmer really go out and have a bunch of fundraisers and get money from lobbyists? No. Elmer wrote a check. Does this wonderful, lengthy piece of legislation do anything to prevent the moneyed elite who want to buy a title from walking in here and writing out a check? No, they don't. In fact, the last race that I ran, in my primary alone, I had a moneyed gentleman step forward who spent $200,000+ just in the primary. Was I, the powerful incumbent, able to raise that amount of money to run against him? Heavens no. I had a hard time raising even half that much. Why did I have a hard time raising even half that much? Because every single person was restricted. They could not give me more than $500. A mom-and-pop service station that had incorporated, because their tax attorney told them, you should incorporate, and this is how many of our small businesses are incorporated. Oops, they were incorporated. Well, I can't take a check from a corporation, can I? Mom and Pop's got to take the money in, then they got to go pay taxes on it, right? And we can't take that evil corporate money, because corporate money somehow is going to be dirty. I think they've gone a long ways in this legislation in getting rid of some of the foolishness and perceptions. And it's probably going to be a nice political gesture for us to tell the world that I think one nice thing about this thing, really nice, we're taking all the municipal folks out of it. When AIPAC came along and was first created, and that was before I got here, the disclosure requirements in AIPAC, and that's why when my colleague in front of me referred to the poor fella that wants to be able to sit on the statewide tattoo board, that he'd have to fill out conflict of interest. Or is that ethics we're talking about? I'm sorry, I was interrupted there, but that's okay.
Senator Green.
We have briefities.
Very unusual to interrupt somebody speaking. Did you have a question or clarification?
Just a clarification. I think there may be a piece of information we need to research because I think the municipalities are still contained.
Well, they're still back in there.
Yes.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought we'd let them out. Well, we ought to let them out. They're nonpartisan. I'd turn them loose. In fact, I'd turn all of you loose because I got faith in every single one of you that you're honorable people. And you know something? The folks who elect you do too. They know you even better than I do because they live around you. They know your kids, and they probably know your dog's name, you know. They know you're not the kind of person that they could send to Juneau or send to Albuquerque and worry about somebody buying you off. That's why you're here, because you got some integrity. I'm proud of the people in this body. I'm proud of these institutions, because we may argue and fight about things, but you know something? When it comes down to it, we each make our own mind up, and I haven't seen the effect or the influence of those awful moneyed things, but I have seen money having influence and effect. I've seen it in the state of Washington, as I mentioned, with Marie Cantwell. I've seen it here in the state of Alaska. I've seen it in the state of New York where 50-some million dollars was spent by one candidate, and he certainly didn't do it at $500 a pop or $1,000 a pop going to talk to people and hoping they would contribute to his campaign. I understand that what we're going to do tonight is we're going to pass this thing, and we're going to move on with it, and we're all going to tell our wives and our husbands and the CPAs and the other people we have to hire and beg to assist us in filling out all of the forms that are necessary. And don't fill out any one I'm wrong, because you can be thrown out of office for failing to disclose that $200 that you got from that old buddy of yours but forgot to write down. That can happen. So we're going to do all these things, and we're going to continue with it, and I'm going to continue to rail against it because I happen to be somebody that believes in you. And I happen to believe in this process, because it's a good one. And I believe in the people that came before us, too. Because long before there was ever an APOC, there was integrity on this floor. And it was maintained by the people on this floor. People that I'm proud to follow in their footsteps. And I'm proud to tell you that you don't need this, but if it makes people feel better, then I guess we got to do it. Thank you.
Senator Ogun.
Thank you. I rise to nibble the bait, but not take the hook. I'll be short. I just wanted to point out that there was an assertion made by the speaker before the last speaker that, you know, the little guy can't get elected. And I just want to remind people that I got elected the first time on a $5,000 budget. My opponent had resources 12 to 1 to mine. It was a 12-year incumbent. And with hard work and the right message, it can happen. So this idea that increasing it is going to totally disadvantage the little guy, it can't happen. And I'm not rich. So end of story. Thanks.
Do we have further debate? Senator Guess.
Thank you, Mr. President. I just want to stand and say the two reasons why I'm voting against. I think there's probably actually some good fixes. We've all had a lot of experiences with APOC. I probably am the only one on this floor that has been a treasurer of a statewide campaign, which I'd recommend never to do. but there's two things that really bother me, and they bother me enough that I don't think this should become law, and I think we should think about it more. One is the increase the limit of the contributions. Now, as someone who has no personal wealth and who's young, an increase in contributions would actually help me. In my race this year, my opponent put in half the money into his campaign. But I still don't think it's a very good thing to do. It makes it harder for young people, I know. It makes it harder for people who don't have personal wealth, I know. But it also makes it better for the public. And I think it makes it better both in reality, and I think it makes it better in cynicism. The other thing that hasn't been touched on that disturbs me is the information. Now, of course, I'm the only member who's gotten married while they've been in office, and my husband had to fill out his first APOC form, and I have to say he wasn't real happy about it. But the fact is that I'm a public servant, and he married a public servant. And his income and his disclosures are important, and they're important for the public to know. It worries me that we're setting the bar lower when it comes to family members. And it really worries me that we're saying you don't need to know the employer if it's $250 or less. Come on, guys. We all know about APOC forms. We all know what happens in contributions. One of the best things about the reporting, who cares about the address? One of the best things about the reporting currently is that you do know the employer at $100 or more. I think it's very important for the public information. You know, it is a perception and reality game, and I would actually agree with the member from Ketchikan. I find that everyone that I've worked with has been wonderful, and they've been ethical, and I don't really think forms like these maybe matter, but they do matter in the public perception of politics, of cynicism, of how politicians are viewed, and they're not viewed as public servants, and we should be. And this just goes, I think, a little bit too far and helps with that cynicism. Thank you, Mr. President.
Do we have further debate? Seeing none, question before the body is, shall committee substitute for Senate Bill 119 Finance pass the Senate? Members may proceed to vote. Secretary will lock the roll. Does any member wish to change his or her vote? Secretary will tally the roll.
12 yeas, 8 nays.
So by a vote of 12 yeas, 8 nays, committee substitute for Senate Bill 119 Finance has passed the Senate. Mr. Majority Leader.
Move the effective date clauses.
The effective date clauses have been passed or moved. Members, please proceed to vote. Senator Green, Secretary will lock the roll. Does any member wish to change his or her vote? Secretary will tally the roll.
13 yeas, 7 nays.
By a vote of 13 yeas, 7 nays, the effective date clauses have failed to pass the Senate. Mr. Minority Leader.
Mr. President, I serve notice of reconsideration of my vote on Senate Bill 100.
Notice of reconsideration on Senate Bill 100. Senator Seekins. Briefities and get briefings. Senate, come back to order. Mr. Majority Leader.
Move the Senate stand in recess till 8 p.m.
We're standing in recess until 8 o'clock. Would the Senate come back to order? Madam Secretary, next item on the calendar.
CS for Senate Bill number 185, Finance, an act providing for a reduction of royalty on certain oil produced from Cook Inlet submerged land and for a credit for certain exploration expenses against oil and gas properties production taxes on oil and gas produced from a lease or property in the state.
We are in third reading. Do we have debate? We're placing a call. We don't have a motion before. Well, I guess we have this item. Call on the has been placed on the Senate for Senate Bill 185. Senator Wagner under debate.
Thank you, Mr. President. Senate Bill 185 provides, in the first place, provides an incentive in the form of royalty relief for 12 platforms in Cook Inlet. And it's what it does, it separates those platforms out into three different categories. One category, the reduction starts at 1,200 barrels, another category at 950, another at 750. And it really saves the integrity of the oil fields in Cook Inlet in the water areas, and it saves the integrity of the platforms and their support services onshore for dewatering the oil, et cetera, and the pipeline system. So this is a good bill. It saves jobs. It may not be a long-term savings. It may be as short as 18 months, and there's some prediction it may be as long as 2 years at the time. That way, through the savings, there will be more production because the fields will be economical for a longer period of time, and that will still allow the state some income anyway, even though they are reducing the royalties. It's much better for the state than to eliminate the platforms at this time. Senate Bill 185 also offers a exploration severance tax credits to explorers for work performed on or after July 1st, 2003, and until July 1st, 2007, which gives a four-year window for exploration and tax credits for that work. The current cost of exploration in Alaska is about 65 cents at this time out of a dollar, compared with Northwest Territories, it's 10 cents. So right now, Alaska is at a real disadvantage when it comes to enticing oil companies to come into the state and explore for oil due to the world market that everybody's competing in for the same dollars for exploration. This is a mechanism to bring about a tax credit, which will put Alaska back in the middle range. And once we're back in the middle range, due to the stability of the United States, due to the stability of the tax system in Alaska, it should entice additional drilling on the in the perimeters. And this bill only allows the tax credit. There's a 20% tax credit for any well drilled 3 miles from an existing well. And then it allows an additional 20% tax credit for any well drilled 25 miles in radius from an existing well. So the further out they go to make the find, the more they get on the tax credit. And the explorer can sell this tax credit. It is a saleable product. And I just say this is a bold step to make Alaska a major player in the world market again. We've lost our place in the world market. The other important part about this is we will not find a basis for revenue to run this state and provide the services we want to provide until we start filling up the pipeline again. The pipeline's running at 50% of capacity at this time, and this bill, with the incentives in it, hopefully will bring that pipeline back up to a respectable level of oil flowing down it each day. Thank you, Mr. President.
Do we have further debate? Senator Elton.
Thank you, Mr. President. I'm not going to try and repeat too much of what was said yesterday, because I think most of the debate yesterday was very pertinent as to whether a person should vote yes or no on this bill. Just a few comments in response to the previous remarks. I mean, this is definitely a good bill in many respects. maybe a bad bill in some respects, but perhaps not. I mean, we don't know whether it's bad. But it's definitely ugly the way the process has gone on this. I applaud the sponsor of the bill for the suggestion that was made well over a month ago now, that we look at the royalty provisions and the way it may extend production from some of the platforms in Cook Inlet. We had extensive committee discussion on those provisions. We know exactly what we will be foregoing, and we can predict accurately what we will be getting with the royalty provisions that were in the original bill. I say it's perhaps bad when I talk about the brand new provisions. I don't know that it's bad. I mean, I can't tell you that those provisions are bad. They may be great. But I don't think we've had the kind of discussion necessary to make a good, informed discussion of whether they're good, great, or bad. I do want to recall the remarks of the member from Bethel made yesterday, that who knows whether 40% is the right number. It could be 5%, 15%, 25%, 27.5%. We don't really know, or I don't think any of us can feel comfortable with the threshold that we did establish in this bill. And I'll just wrap up on the ugly part. I really do think that it is the wrong thing to do to push this through in a couple of days. I mean, let's assume that the bite is going to be $50 million a year for 4 years. I don't know. I don't think anybody really knows what it's going to be. But, I mean, that's like $25 million a day that we divided by 2 days. We ought not be taking on these huge kinds of things this late in the session. I mean, it's a good thing we don't have a 90-day session, because that would mean that the governor couldn't drop a bill in on the 112th day, and we couldn't have it on the floor on the 115th day. We need to take our times when the fiscal import is as large as it could be in this bill. I'm sorry I'm voting no, because I do suspect that maybe if we had spent more time on this and we had better answers, I might vote differently. But I'm not going to vote on something that I don't have a comfort level with, and 2 days can't give me a comfort level, Mr. President.
Do we have further debate? Seeing none, Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I knew there was a reason somebody called the Senate, so I could speak. You know, I think I spoke on the issue yesterday, but I would like to address a different issue, and that is the fiscal note. You know, how are we going to pay for it? You know, I think that the previous speaker mentioned that briefly, but in the fiscal note, there's the potential that it may cost $100 million for the next year. So we're looking at a potential impact of $400 million. You know, and I, you know, as a businessman, I know that you have to, many times you have to invest in order to make money, but we don't know what that target is. We don't know if this is a, you know, the tax credit is of 20% and 40% is on target or not on target, and I think we're gambling in that endeavor, and that gives me great concern. But even greater, I guess, we're willing to take that gamble, and it may cost us millions of dollars, and we know that at the maximum, the implementation of this bill is going to cost us up to $100 million a year or $400 million. And even tonight, we're looking at the phase out and the complete elimination of programs to seniors. You know, and I don't know if that is a good idea, but here we're going to spend money. We're talking about there was an amendment on sales tax to charitable gaming, so we're looking at that endeavor. It seems on one end we're willing to nickel and dime the state's operating budget and other programs, but on the other hand, we're willing to take a bill that we haven't seen for, you know, less than 72 hours and take big risks. to me, that doesn't make much sense. And I said earlier that if I had the time to analyze this bill, I might be one of its biggest supporters, because I'm well aware of the deficit that this state is facing. But this bill next year may cost $100 million, and where are the dollars going to come from? We can say that this is going to bring in hundreds of millions of dollars, but we must look at the cash flow. We all know that we only have $2 billion in the CBR, and although we are talking about, at least talking about revenue measures, I don't believe that adding to the deficit without a discussion on the cash flow and how do we get out of here does make much good business sense. At present, I believe we have the $2 billion. The governor wants to limit the CBR draw to $400 million. Add this $100 million to it, that'll be $500 million. The results from this program are not going to be realized within the next 4 years. I would say that 8 years may be more realistic, and even that will be optimistic. So I would say that by adopting this, if we do the maximum, we will burn out the CBR, and we will not have a plan to, even if we adopt the sales tax measure, and I think the amendments that currently, and I know we're not supposed to talk about other legislation, but that, I think, has been reduced from the $400 million down to about $180 million in revenue. So it seems as though, even though this may bring in additional dollars, we don't have a good business plan to address the cash flow of this state. And when you do not address the cash flow problems that this state is facing, all programs, including education, are at risk. And that is why, with I think we need to take time and take a real good look at what we're giving away on this big gamble in Senate Bill 185. And you know, I believe that it may have potential, but I haven't had the opportunity to fulfill what I believe are my fiduciary responsibilities to the citizens of the state.
Senator Taylor.
Yes, thank you, Mr. President. I want the body to understand, I totally share the comments of my good colleagues, both from Juneau and Bethel. That consternation, that concern is in my heart, just like it is in yours. But you know, there comes a time when, through courage, through some level of leadership, somebody has to step forward and say, three new wells, exploratory wells, being drilled on the north slope of Alaska is inadequate for our needs. It's inadequate for the development of our resource base. It is certainly inadequate for the revenues that we're going to have to rely upon in the future to keep the lights on in this building and those classrooms heated. I share that concern. And just like my colleagues, I believe the issue was brought to us late in the session when there's limited time within which to explore all of the options. But I, for one, am willing to take that risk. I'm willing to challenge, if you will, and I think the governor has, and I applaud him for doing it. I think the governor is basically saying to the oil industry, here's a four-year window. Do your exploration, and we'll give you a credit. In that four-year period, look at what we may produce. That may very well be the thing that we'll be spending on this floor 5, 6, 7 years from now. That may be that new revenue. Is it a bold step? It certainly is. I think there's a secondary step, though, we're all forgetting. Because the biggest single impact that this will have is an immediate influx of jobs into the entire rail belt. Somebody's got to go out and do that seismic work. Somebody's got to set up the camp. Somebody else has to cook food for them. Somebody else has to fly supplies in. This is not going to be a small gesture on the part of industry from what we've been told. I literally see hundreds, if not thousands, of new jobs coming out of this incentive package. And what are we losing in the process? We're losing only that amount which can be offset as against production. Now, true, because of the transferability aspects within the bill, a person can do the exploration, spend the money. By the way, that money's 99% of it's going to be spent on jobs and labor. All of these are Alaskans working out there. You take those jobs and that labor, which we get the benefit of now, and then it gets offset against production in oil. Production that is going to be hopefully enhanced and flowing down that pipe, paying us, the legislature, the money we need to run the state. First, you get the initial burst out of jobs themselves. Secondarily, historically, probably is a better way to approach this, we know that given X amount of exploration, it normally will develop into X amount of production. There's no hard and fast rules about that. But if you're not going to spend the money to go look, you're never going to have anything to pump. And these credits can only be used against production. So as the exploration develops future production, and that future production is coming down the line, I firmly believe that with the untapped resources in oil that we have in this state, you're going to have two significant benefits. One will be the increased flow and production. And there's a subtle benefit that our people told us about that I've advocated for years. This will attract independents. If anything will attract independent oil drillers and oil explorers, this is it. And how are you going to know if you're really getting a good deal out of BP or a good deal out of Phillips or if the market is truly fair when the market is so narrow and so limited? The way you find that out is have a whole lot more players in the market. And if you've got a whole lot more players in the market, there's going to be a much more competitive market as far as the utilization and extraction of that resource. I share each one of the concerns that have been expressed. This could be a risky gamble if you look at only the downside. Personally, I'm an optimist. I believe in the dream that we all share in this resource base of ours. But that can only come true if we take some risks now to develop some production later. I agree it's a scary proposition, but I think it's well worth the risk for our future.
Further debate? We freeze.